that didn't happen very quickly. We are seeing some more for sale now, but we're on the residential side. Our fund really only deals with first lien residential mortgages. And I know the commercial lending space has had a much different time than we have.
You're listening to Ice Cream with Investors, a podcast that is dedicated to teaching you how to better invest your money so that you can live a more intentional life. I'm your host, Matt Four, and it is my goal to teach and empower you to remove the roadblocks to your financial success.
All right, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Well, we like to start with the difficult questions here. What's your favorite ice cream?
So if I'm going to make a bad decision, I'm going to go a little bit out in left field. It's technically not a scoop of ice cream. It's the ice cream cookie sandwich, you know, with a chocolate chip cookie on each side of the vanilla. That's really the winner for me.
Okay. Do you have like a favorite brand?
No, there's a local ice cream shop here that makes them. So, you know, I'll go local. There's always one in the freezer aisle of the grocery store. And if you need one, you'll just grab whatever they have.
So one of the internet memes popped up on my social media the other day. There was somebody apparently who's 100 years old, and they asked her, like, how did you get to live the way you are? And she said she ate a Klondike ice cream bar every day for the past like 80 years or something like that.
Wow. I'm going to have to. Yeah, I think you can justify that now. You know, eating one of those every day is health food, right? One a day.
Exactly. Exactly.
Keep you alive till 100.
You're just trying to live to 100.
Yeah.
Well, tell our listeners, what's the scoop? What do you do today?
Again, my name's Andrew. I work at Labrador Lending. I'm a senior portfolio manager there. Labrador Lending runs two funds. One is for non-performing notes, and the other one is for performing notes. These two funds are a way for passive investors to access the mortgage debt space. These funds are for accredited investors only, and we, as they say, we buy mortgages on the secondary market. We don't originate any loans, but after big banks and other organizations have to sell the debt off because it's non-performing or they just want to trim their portfolio, we buy it on the secondary market. And when it's non-performing, we work with borrowers to find a solution that works for them and us to keep them in their homes and keep them paying. And that way we can deliver a return to our investors by keeping them in their house.
Awesome. Well, a lot of big words there with portfolio manager, first position liens and notes and all that. So before we get into kind of what that all is, tell us, how did you get into real estate? How did you get into this role?
Well, I was a product manager at a software company, and that software company was a fintech. We made a dashboard for financial advisors. And as a product manager, I was responsible for the alternative investment section of the platform. And as part of that job, I had to research all the things that were not publicly traded, from private equity, hedge funds. This includes real estate, distressed debt, all of these things. And I became more interested in the underlying than building the software for other people. I had a break from work. My wife was diagnosed with cancer in 2019, and she went through chemo and surgery and radiation. And I took a break from work to help her along that journey. She's doing fine now, no evidence of disease. But when that was over, I didn't want to go back to my old job, and I started researching this area, and I connected with two great fund managers by listening to their podcast, Jamie Bateman and Chris Sevigny. Some of your listeners might know who they are. And I ended up connecting with Jamie, and he needed some help with his fund. And I said, here's my background. I've got financial experience. And I started working for him. And that was a year and a half, almost 2 years ago.
Gotcha. So at Labrador Lending, you all focus on notes.
Yes.
Let's start this conversation at a high level and help our listeners understand what is a note, if that's
sure.
A new term.
Yeah, let's bring it back, because I know your listening base may have some renters out there, may have some homeowners. But when you buy a home, most people borrow money from a bank or other organization to buy that home. They use leverage. So a note is simply nothing more than a promise to pay. A mortgage is a pledge of physical real estate to back up that promise to pay. So you borrow money from the bank and you pledge the house as collateral. And that is what a note is. And most borrowers borrow the money and they make their payments on time and they live there for a while, or maybe until the end of the loan, or maybe they sell it and move on to from a starter home to a dream home or something like that. But some borrowers run into trouble. They miss a few payments. They have unexpected medical bills, or they have some other life event that prevents them from fulfilling their obligation as a borrower. Big banks are publicly traded, and since the great financial crisis, 06, 07, there are a lot more rules about banks holding toxic debt. So quite often they sell it off, and they take a loss on their P&L, and they sell it at a discount to buyers like us. And we raise money from accredited investors, so we're a private fund. We're not publicly traded. So we raise money to go buy that debt on the secondary market. And then we work with the borrower to try to find a solution for them to keep them in their house, because borrowers with equity in their house are very incentivized to stay there and work something out. You know, these, we do not shop for loans where the borrower is underwater or something like that. And a lot, for a lot of Americans, the equity in their home is one of the best savings accounts or investments they have. And they're very motivated to protect that equity and work with us to try to come up with a loan modification or some other agreement that would keep them in their house and keep them paying, even if it's less than what they were paying before. Just getting them paying again and performing on the loan, it's good for them because they can demonstrate a pay history. It's good for us because we buy it at a discount and all of a sudden they're paying more. So that's really the investment thesis. And as home values have gone up over the last decade for various reasons that we can get into later, there are a lot of properties out there, a lot of single family residences where there's equity in the property still.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So you mentioned at the beginning that you all do not originate any loans. Is that correct?
We do not originate any loans. It's really, it's a different business than what we do. Origination is really a velocity of money. You know, a lot of originators borrow money from the government, and then when they originate the loan, they collect the fees up front and then quickly sell off the loan to another organization. And so there, it's really a business of going through the loan documents and quickly coming to a decision and then getting a fee and then getting your money back out of that quickly. And that's not what we do.
Yeah. And that's a common misperception out there, is when a normal borrower goes into Bank of America, JP Morgan, XYZ Bank, whatever it is in your local neighborhood, chances are that they're just doing that, right? They're originating the loan, they're getting charged their fees, and you know, 31 days later after they can show a payment history, or 61 days later after they can show that you actually paid on your loan, they're selling it off to other folks. Do you all ever buy performing notes right after they're originated, or are you only focused on non-performing loans?
Well, we focus on having a solid pay history of at least 12 months, and we feel that backs up our investment thesis and it makes it a much more predictable outcome for us. Safe is not the right word. There's nothing without risk. But we can predict based on the last 12 months, we can do a whole lot. We can estimate what's going to happen based on the previous 12 months. Whereas if they're only 1 or 2 months, there, you never know what's going to happen.
Right, right. So do you all buy any performing loans?
Oh yeah, we have two funds. The Integrity Income Fund is currently open to new investors. It pays an 8% annual return. We do a monthly distribution on that. So that is mostly full of performing notes. We have another fund that's currently closed to new investors. It's a fund with a limited term. It's only 3 years long, and it'll be up. It'll be closed next year. And with that closure, we anticipate, I can't talk much about the details, but we anticipate having a replacement for it when the time comes. But that fund is full of non-performing notes. It gotcha. Does not offer a regular distribution because non-performing notes, you don't know when you're going to get paid because a bankruptcy in some states, bankruptcy is a federal thing, but a foreclosure in some states could be very quick. In some states, it could be very long. Some loans go through bankruptcy and then we work something out after that. On a non-performing note where they're not paying, it's really hard to predict when you'll get paid.
To make sure that we all understand the definitions, what is a non-performing note in the sense of how you all look at it?
Yeah, we look at it as over the last 12 months, they've only made two or three payments, or it's in somebody else has begun foreclosure on it, or it's in bankruptcy. We say that's a non-performer. A performing note is really over the last year, they've probably made all their payments and at least 10 of them on time. You know, everybody it happens to the best of us. Everybody can be a couple weeks late on a payment, but if they've made them all mostly on time, we call that a performer.
Gotcha. And so in a non-performing sense, you are going in and you are buying that off of the bank's balance sheet.
Yes.
I guess first question I have is, where do you even find non-performing loans? Is there like a marketplace out there?
There are several great websites you can go to. PaperStack is one of them. DebEx is another, and that trades in all kinds of distressed debt. There are brokers in this market that have a list of sellers and buyers that they talk with regularly. Unfortunately, there is no centralized exchange. So this is nothing at all like stocks and bonds you see publicly traded. So it's an opaque secondary market. And so we work with both brokers and individual websites to look at deals as they come down from the sell side.
Yeah. Well, anytime there's a non-centralized exchange, all I hear right there is there's margin involved, right?
There is margin. It's like dealing with a real estate agent. The broker gets paid a fee for connecting buyers and sellers. And sometimes we are the seller. And so we appreciate knowing these brokers because if we buy a non-performing loan and work out a modification or a conversion of some type, and it becomes more valuable, we're more than happy to sell it to somebody who wants a performing note. And that way they get a great stream of cash flows and we get a return on our investment for our investors.
So let's talk through how you all price these things. So you've got a non-performing loan, you're talking with a broker, they send you over, I think it's called a tape, if I'm not mistaken, of loans that are non-performing. It'll list the address, the unpaid balance, how much they're behind, all those sorts of things. Where do you even start thinking about the number you want to offer for that note? Like, is there a range of 60 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar? What does that all look like?
That's a great way to frame it. 60 to 80 cents on the dollar of unpaid balance, but there's always an adjustment to that in our mind as we analyze. The industry term is a tape, but it's really a spreadsheet with addresses and financial information. Sometimes there will be additional balances owed, like legal fees or other late fees that have that the borrower has incurred, and that gets added on but not paid out at the same rate. So it's a very subjective bidding process. And when a broker is interested in selling something, he or she will get a range of bids anywhere from 60 to 80 cents on the dollar. And it depends on the buyer's appetite for risk, their analysis of the situation, and also their portfolio. A lot of these spreadsheets, these tapes come out with a list of, any state in the union can have these, but a lot of investors prefer a specific state, like maybe Texas or something like that. And so they'll overbid for those. Whereas if we already have assets in that state, just for diversification purposes, we'll underbid that. And if we get a good deal, we'll take it. So it's very subjective, but 60 to 80 cents on the dollar for non-performers. Sometimes higher lately, it depends on what state it's in. The time value of money has increased lately. So the quicker you can get your money back, the more valuable that is to some investors. Also experience. We have some states we work in, we have attorneys and connections that are very experienced in working with these assets. So we see that as a value for our fund. And so we're more adept at turning some of these some of these less loved loans, we're more adept at turning those into profitable outcomes for our investors.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never even thought about like having, hey, I know these resources in these states, but over in Oregon, for instance, or Washington, I have no idea who I'd even contact. So let's just say no to those.
Yeah, and every state is different. Foreclosure is a state by state matter, and all 50 states in the union, it varies quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you are saying 60 to 80 cents on the unpaid balance, are you factoring in interest into that, or you're just taking the straight up unpaid balance if they were to pay you tomorrow?
So we're just doing a percentage of the unpaid balance. For a non-performer, it depends a little bit. We do take the coupon rate into account. Again, notes with higher percentage, 8, 9, 10%. Those are a little more valuable because if you do get them paying again, the interest you collect is greater. But if the borrower is not paying at all and hasn't paid in a very long time, the coupon rate or the rate listed on the note is less relevant. So again, that's it's a very subjective bid. It is a subjective bidding process.
Got it. So you are looking at this tape. You've identified 4 to 5 assets that you want to purchase. You're able to purchase those from the broker or whoever has control of the tape. Talk us through, like, what are your steps in terms of trying to get the borrower back on a payment schedule? And just a side note, this is one of the reasons why I connected with Jamie the first time I connected with him, is because the creativity you can have in this space is phenomenal. You're buying these cents at 80 cents on the dollar, and now you are the bank dictating how the borrower pays back to you. So I've always found this space interesting. So maybe talk us through, like, the steps after you acquire a note.
Sure. The first thing we do after all the legal documents are signed and recorded with the local municipality, we place the loan, we transfer the servicing to a servicer that's great at working with investors like us. We work with BiFi loan servicing quite a bit. They're not licensed in every state, but where we can, we work with them. Because the most important thing is a good line of communication between lender, servicer, and borrower. We always work with a licensed servicer because of the state laws around collecting debts throughout the United States. It's just so much more advantageous to the lender to work with a licensed servicer. It's almost a must have. So establishing a good line of communication with the borrower is paramount. And we found BiFi is great at that. And then asking them, you know, kind of getting to the bottom of why they're having trouble with this. Was it just one surprise medical bill? Did they lose their job? We've actually helped borrowers. We've pointed them to homeowner assistance funds throughout the country that are available from the federal government, distributed to the states because of COVID and those impacts. We worked with a lot of borrowers to basically get them back on their feet and get them caught up, and establishing that line of communication and understanding the root of the problem is really the first two things we do.
Gotcha. So are there any tips or tricks in terms of how your servicer gets in contact with these borrowers, or is that a common thing that is hard to do? Talk to
somebody. Yeah, it's generally hard to do because unfortunately there's a lot of shame and just difficult circumstances for the borrowers when they're down on their luck. That's tough to face up to. A lot of them have other problems going on, whether it's work or family or health. Or not having good internet connectivity. We've dealt with that before. I know many of us have nice new smartphones at this day and age, but a lot of people don't, or don't have reliable internet service. It's been cut off for lack of payment or something like that. So it is tough, but BiFi is pretty good at understanding where the borrower's at and trying to meet them where they are. So they're a pretty high touch loan servicer, and that helps us get things done.
What are some of the creative ways that you've been able to kind of get borrowers back on track?
We've offered, there was one asset we owned where they experienced a death in the family and it was heartbreaking. So we simply offered to defer 3 payments till the end of the loan. And they were able to meet that new agreement and continue to make the payments as agreed. And that looks great on their credit report and on their servicing history because they did everything we said that they need to do. We've offered loan modifications. We've simply asked people, borrowers, what can you pay? If you can't make this payment on the note that you thought you could make back when you took out this loan and circumstances change, what can you make now? And they're quite often able to make something very close, but not quite what's on the face value of the note. And so we will, if they can come to the table with cash, like a little bit of a down payment, so to speak, to get this modification in gear, we'll also forgive some of the balance and kind of meet them in the middle and define a new payment that they say they can make. And then we'll modify the loan and say, and have them sign a document and say, okay, this loan is now, these are the terms, these are the new terms of it. And they sign that and they go forward on that payment plan and they can make those payments. And then it's a win-win for everybody. They get to stay in their house. We don't have to pay legal fees for foreclosure. and they get to keep their equity. And we all of a sudden go from a non-performing note to a performing note. And that's more valuable for our investors. It does take some time. And then we hold that for a little while to get a good payment history. And we'll often sell that at a profit.
Yeah, I think when I was first researching this space, I heard a story about, you know, somebody missing three payments. A loan servicer reached out to him, got in contact with them. And basically they said, well, I didn't even know that I could, you know, modify the loan. I thought I had to pay all three payments or I was going to be in default. So I just stopped paying. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you all are able to be creative with a borrower and say, no, we'll move those three payments to the back. We'll discount your loan by $100 a month and add on additional months. Like, you can really be creative to get that loan to back to performing, I guess.
Absolutely. We can be creative and nimble, whereas some larger organizations, they have so many rules. It's like, you took out this loan at this rate, we can't do anything for you. Sometimes they'll offer a deferment, but they won't. They really hesitate to modify things. Whereas we, since we're buying on a secondary market and we're good at negotiating deals, we have a lot of flexibility to offer them something new. We don't create contract for deeds, but a contract for deed is, it's almost like a rent to own arrangement where the deed stays with the lender, not the buyer. And so if somebody is paying on their contract for deed, if they have a consistent pay history, we'll say, hey, we'd like to convert you to a note and mortgage, which is a much better form of ownership for you. And it's a win-win situation for everybody involved.
What is a note and mortgage?
A note and mortgage is sort of the standard. You go to the bank, you borrow, and then when most people buy a house and they borrow from the bank, the deed goes into the borrower's name. So that in a foreclosure, you start with the assumption that the borrower gets to keep the house. There is another more, I'll call it dicey, but there a contract for deed where the lender of on the loan will keep the deed in the lender's name. And the borrower has to pay the contract in full before they get the deed in their name. That makes it much more likely that if they don't pay, they'll get kicked out without a foreclosure process. It's a contract default, not a true foreclosure on a primary residence. So it's not very borrower friendly at all. They have all the obligations of home ownership, but none of the rights in court of having a deed in their name. So it's not a good situation for them at all. And it's somewhat predatory to create these things. And some municipalities have outright banned them. So we try to get them, we try to just convert them to note and mortgage as much as possible.
So you're buying these non-performing loans, let's call it 60 to 80% cents on the dollar. You you get in touch with the borrower, you do some sort of loan modification, you get them back on track. They've got 12 months of payment history now. Is your goal really to sell that off as a performing loan? Do you keep that in house and kind of let it amortize down? What is your strategy once you get it performing?
Hey, fellow investors, before we dive into our next segment of the show, I wanted to take a quick moment to talk to you about a fantastic opportunity for you to invest with me. As you know, here at Ice Cream with Investors, I'm passionate about real estate investing and helping you navigate the exciting world of wealth creation through real estate. And that's why, for the first time, I'm thrilled to tell you about an opportunity for you to invest alongside of me. Over the past 3 years, I've been investing in multifamily, mobile home parks, car washes. I've even become the bank and lent out money to fellow real estate investors on a short-term basis. And now you can come join me. If you would like to jump on a call and learn more about this opportunity, head to icecreamwithinvestors.com/invest and find a time for us to connect. And now back to the show.
Sure. In the portfolio, we like to have a mix of performers and non-performers. It helps us manage our cash flow because as a fund, we have expenses from software to, you know, people that work for us, legal fees, we have that. So we need to balance our cash flow as a fund. So we like to keep it a roughly even mix of performers and non-performers in the non-performing fund. But some of it, again, we buy something, think it's going to be performing and it goes non-performing. We buy a non-performer and get it performing again. It's a constant juggling act. But in the other fund that's currently open to new investors right now, the Integrity Income Fund, that is almost entirely performing loans.
Gotcha. Well, just so our listeners can know how nerdy I am dying to see your spreadsheet at the end of this call to figure out how
it,
you kind of
share to you.
Balance that out.
Yeah.
Let's say you go off and try to sell the asset after it's performing. We're buying it at 60 to 80 cents on the dollar. What are you typically selling it at? Is it 90, 97? What does that look
like? Yeah, selling is a little higher. And it depends on the coupon rate and it depends on the state. We often sell and we think, you know, the buyers are looking for a yield on their investment of about, you know, 12 to 14%. It depends, you know, sometimes as low as 10 if it's a really solid performer in an easy to foreclose state like Texas. So sometimes people will accept a lower yield on their cash, more like 10, but it's low teens generally. And that's where we like to sell our assets. So when it's performing, you can model the cash flows just like any other bond and analyze it that way. So on the performing side, it's a little more of a yield-based calculation. And that fluctuates with the market. There's been some ebbs and flows over the last couple of years of more buyers than sellers, more sellers than buyers. So it's an interesting time. Things are changing. So for earlier this year, we weren't seeing very many for sale. I think that's improved quite a bit lately. So, you know, that's the economics of it. Buyers and sellers have to be matched up too.
Yeah, and I'm assuming there weren't a lot of notes for sale at the beginning of the year or even late 2022 because the treasury was so low, right? I'm assuming a lot of this is based off of what is the 10-year treasury and the risk premium we associate with having to have a borrower pay our yield versus the United States government. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, that's part of it. There's also, we think, a lot of larger institutions or a lot of sellers were perhaps holding. They may have wanted to sell some things, but they said, let's hold out for a little bit and see what happens next quarter. Additionally, there were some bank failures earlier this year.
Heard of them.
Yeah. So we thought there would be, you know, being on this side of the market, we thought there would be quite a few more assets for sale very quickly, and that hasn't quite come to that didn't happen very quickly. We are seeing some more for sale now, but we're on the residential side. Our fund really only deals with first lien residential mortgages, and I know the commercial lending space has had a much different time than we have.
Got it. So I love what you're saying really around the idea that there was more sellers or not as many sellers and now there are more sellers. How do you position yourself to go buy SVB's loan balance when they default?
You have to have a lot more money than we have. It's a very large portfolio. So it's a little bit above. We're a smaller, more boutique fund, but there are some bigger funds out there that I'm sure are, you know, like the $100, $200, $300 million funds are working on some of the bank assets that are being sold off. Again, from what I read in the news, a lot of it is commercial, and that's not my expertise, and that's our fund doesn't do that at all. So right now we're residential only.
Yeah. Well, speaking of bank failures, though, did you see the family organization that bought SVB's assets?
I don't know which family. No, who was that?
It's somebody over in North Carolina. I think it's like the Matthews family or something like that. Anyways, I went on a deep dive from them whenever they made the acquisition. And apparently, like, this is their strategy. They go, when big banks fail, they go in and buy them, and they've quickly built up their balance sheet to be like one of the largest banks in the world, because they're just going up and gobbling up these banks like that.
Wow. Hey, it's good to have a bunch of cash sitting on the sidelines when a crisis hits.
Yeah, I'll do some more research on that.
Yeah.
So the balance of performing and non-performing, you've got your exit strategies. How are you preparing for kind of what's going on now? And I guess tell us where you think the note industry is going to go here in the next couple of quarters.
I think, you know, we're preparing by taking good care of the assets we own. Our asset management process is pretty well established, you know, checking on insurance, checking taxes, make sure everything's in good order with what we do own. But preparing assets that we think are ready, that we've improved in quality and we can sell for more than we bought it for. We're in the process of selling some of those right now to increase our cash position. Just in general about the industry, not speaking about what we manage on a day-to-day basis, I think there's going to be a broadening of what investors are going after in the debt investment space. I think everybody's going to have to diversify a little bit because residential loans or residential homes have gone up in value. There's just fewer and fewer assets to be had. So a lot of colleagues that we talk to are looking at investing or lending in vacant land or lending on other distressed debt types of like bridge loans and things like that. So a lot of people are diversifying their portfolio and not saying like, hey, I only do notes, when the time may not be right on the buy side. So there's a lot of diversification and there are a lot of great investors putting out content about that right now.
Have you all thought about mobilizing some capital to be some of these bridge positions in larger assets?
We've looked at it, but right now our fund mandate, we're kind of sticking to the fund mandate. But when we think about what comes next, after we deliver a positive return to our current investors, I think it's only natural for us to keep going, but broaden our own mandate. But I don't know how much I'm allowed to talk about that because it's not nailed down in stone. And I think I'm a little naive on the securities regulations on what I'm about to allowed to talk about.
You got it. We'll switch topics here. Sure. So I want to change this now to our last round. We call this the four toppings. Our first one is, what is your favorite book, or what is a book that you've read recently that's given you a paradigm shift?
So recently I read Breakfast with Seneca by a guy named Fideler. And it's a book on stoicism. And I think Ryan Holiday is another author who's written a lot of great books about stoicism, but this is just one that I ran into and it grabbed me. I think a friend recommended it to me and it was just really accessible and down to earth. And it just blew my mind. Like the human condition, some of the things we all struggle with, it's been around for like 2,000 years and probably longer, but the early Greek and Roman Stoic philosophers were some of the first to write it down and leave it with us. So I think it's comforting and it's also informative at the same time. So I really enjoyed reading about Stoicism lately.
So I agree on Ryan Holiday. He wrote The Obstacle Is the Way and a bunch of Stoic books like that. But in terms of debt books, do you have a favorite book that you read that helped you understand this space a little bit better?
Lean Lord by Eric Shiraga. It's one of the more recent releases in the residential note debt space. But I thought it was really accessible. It had some great info on calculations. He also talked a lot about second lien mortgages, which is not something we've dealt with a lot, but it had a lot of discussion in there because, you know, first lien is the first loan. A second lien is the second loan to get paid back in the event of a sale or other foreclosure action. So I thought it was really comprehensive but it was only about residential first lien debt. It wasn't like a true debt investing like textbook. It was really just about one little part of the space, but I thought it was a great read.
Got it. Well, I mean, a debt investing textbook sounds dry by its very nature. So it's nice to have a little bit of color in there.
And it's great because it's really interesting that a lot of debt and real estate debt investors have come to the space after being landlords or owning assets with renters in them. And then they're just tired of the tenants and toilets. And they just like, I just want the debt. I don't want any of these other headaches. And so they've kind of moved on from owning the entire asset to just owning the debt. And it's an interesting evolution. So I think that's something a lot of real estate investors might need to hear, is that they're eventually going to want to go around and just be involved with the debt.
Yeah. Well, once you understand the debt, you understand who controls what and how they control it. Yeah. I will give a plug for Jim Napier's book, Invest in Debt. When I read that, again, I'm just an internal geek. He just basically has the formula. He's like, you determine how much money you want to make, and then you can determine how much you want to buy an asset for and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, and that's one of the classics in the space. I haven't read that one, but I've heard that mentioned like five times. That's a great one.
It's,
to pick up.
Really hard to find. I think I had to spend $35 online to buy the book because it was a book written in the 70s. So it's really hard to find.
Yeah.
Our second one is, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
So I wish I could credit the one person who told me this, but early on, somebody explained to me that like everybody you run into in your life, whether you work with them or are just friends with them, everybody is going to have something that they're great at, like a skill that you don't have or subject matter expertise that you've never run into before. And it would be wise to figure out what that everybody's superpower is and learn that from them, because they probably learned it the hard way or learned it by like studying and paying money to go learn it from somebody else. So it would be wise to figure out like what people are good at and absorb that without going through it the hard way. And I've tried to do that as much as possible.
What's your superpower?
I don't know. I wish people would tell me that. I do a lot of things. I think I'm not bad at collecting information from a variety of places, like looking at the tapes that are coming in and reading the mortgage documents and knowing, listening to industry podcasts and forming a general idea of what we should be doing. I pride myself on being like a T-shaped person, and I work more lately on the top of the T, like a little bit of knowledge everywhere, and try to synthesize that into a direction of action. So that's what I think I'm good at.
Our third one is, what are you most proud of in your life?
So I'm pretty proud of bouncing back from 2019 for us. My wife was diagnosed with late stage cancer, and she went through chemo and surgery and radiation, and it was tough. It was worse for her than it was for me, I guarantee you. But it was still a life altering year. And at the time we had two young kids, we still have two young kids, but they were even younger back then. And I'm pretty proud of bouncing back to that. I'm back at work, and I found a really good balance of, hey, I'm contributing to this fund from operations and all those perspectives, but still living life and enjoying it to the fullest. I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear about your wife too, because I can't imagine that happening. Life is a very fragile thing, and you don't realize it until it happens to someone special. Yes. And someone you really care about.
Yeah, and nobody expects to get late stage cancer in their 30s. So it's
right.
Yeah, it's tough.
Our fourth and last one is, if you could sit down and eat a bowl of ice cream with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I've listened to your podcast before, and I really caught this question, and I said, you know what, my gut reaction was like, I'd love to sit down with my younger self and lecture me on all the things I'm doing wrong. But honestly, I know we covered the authors earlier, but Michael Lewis, he's an author of a couple of really great books, but I just think he tells great stories and has a lot of really interesting knowledge. And I'd really like to sit down and listen to maybe some of the stories that aren't on the record or that he hasn't written down yet. And just try to grasp from him how to be a better storyteller, because someday I'd like to have an interesting story to tell. And maybe I do. I just, I'm more into spreadsheets than writing. So maybe I'm not ready to write as well as I could, but maybe someday.
Yeah. Well, Michael Lewis wrote The Big Short, The Blind Side, Moneyball, and I think he just launched a new book here recently.
Quite a few that are on my list that I haven't caught up with, but in another life, I was living in a suburb of Oakland and going to a lot of the A's games during the Billy Bean Moneyball era. So when that book came out, I was like, wow, it was kind of mind blowing for me.
Yeah, it definitely changes the way you look at the world too after watching that movie.
Absolutely.
Well, Andrew, fantastic conversation. I appreciate your insights on this industry, an industry I know very well from a high level, but not too deep. So I appreciate that conversation. But if our listeners wanted to reach out to you, learn more about you, learn about the Labrador Lending and what you all do over there, where's the best place we can point them?
Sure. LabradorLending.com has access to all of our fund pages. It has a connection to the servicer we use quite a bit. And the podcast by the fund manager, Jamie Bateman, he has his own podcast, Adversity to Abundance. And I know you were a guest on that a while ago. And so just find us on the podcast, find us at LabradorLending.com. I think we're also on LinkedIn, but those are the big ones.
Perfect. We will link out those in the show notes. And then Andrew, thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Thank you for listening to Ice Cream with Investors. If you like what we serve you here, it would mean the world to me if you would like, subscribe, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app.